So, first of all, that new book which was published only this month, Don't Worry, Be Grumpy. I'm allergic to giving public talks. That sometimes in our modern world, especially in psychology, we're always supposed to be happy. And in fact, if we're not happy, sometimes we have to see a psychologist. We think that something's wrong with us. Our friends say, "What's up? You're not happy today." And once a young lady in Australia, she said, "But I don't feel like being happy. And when I'm not happy, I feel so guilty." And so she said, "I feel so grumpy today." I said, "What's wrong with being grumpy?" She said, "It's not allowed in today's society." And so I went to my office very quickly, and I got on the computer, and I printed out a grumpy license. And the grumpy license says something like, "I hereby give you permission to be grumpy at any time, for any reason, or no reason at all." And I signed it to give it authority for the rest of your life. Because one of the problems is, when we try to be happy, then we get miserable. It's the same with people with depression. There are so many people with depression in our modern world. And one of the things which I do when I talk to people who have clinical depression, not deep depression, but just the average depression, I tell them, if you're depressed, milk it for everything it's got. When you're depressed, you don't have to go to work in the morning. Oh, what joy. When you're depressed, you can sleep in. Isn't that wonderful? When you're depressed, you can eat whatever you like. And I'm just going to go off on a tangent here, because one of my friends some years ago, now he had terrible cancer. He was getting old. He was in his late 70s, early 80s. And eventually he had to go to the hospice. You have hospices in Halifax, where people can actually have palliative care and, you know, die comfortably. So he went to our local hospice. And as soon as he went into the hospice, when the nurses said, "What do you want for dinner?" He said, "Well, look, I can't have any sweets because I've got diabetes. I can't have oily food because of high cholesterol. And I can't have salt, and I can't have this." And the nurse said, "What do you mean? You're dying. The cancer's going to kill you before you're going to get cardiac problems or diabetes, or so eat whatever you want." He said, "Really?" Because the last 5 or 10 years, he couldn't eat what he liked. You know, his wife wouldn't let him. So all his favorite foods, full of fat, full of sugar, full of salt, for the first time in years, he could eat all of that. And about a month later, he was released from hospice because he got better. Eventually he went back there and died properly. We had another sort of year of life. But what happened there is because, you know, of a little bit of happiness, because, you know, we don't just live by food, we also exist through happiness as well. Just giving himself some happiness there actually increased his health, which is any sort of psychologist and doctor would know. Now look at me, you know, sort of sometimes you look at me and you think, "You are overweight, Ajahn Brahm," which is one of the reasons when you said that, please, his title is Bhante. That's actually not. These days people call me His Roundness, Ajahn Brahm. But I'm not afraid, actually, because I learned a long time ago, there must be a few medical practitioners here, that somebody sent me the article, because I was trained in science. If you're happy and you laugh, your blood vessels expand. But if you're miserable, angry, upset, your blood vessels contract. And so, I have been laughing and happy for so many years. My blood vessels are so wide. I can eat anything. And all that gut can flow through without any traffic jams. Strokes, heart attacks will not happen. But if you're fat and miserable, you're going to die. So anyone is overweight, you better start laughing quick. And yeah, that answered a lot of questions for me. Because I always wondered, have you ever noticed that fat people are always happy? Always jolly. When I grew up, there was a TV series, Robin Hood. And the character I was impressed with so much was Friar Tuck. Remember Friar Tuck, some of you? He was fat and happy. So he was my idol. He was the one I wanted to live up to. Maybe I've achieved that now. But also, who's the other happy person with a very long life, who's very fat? Santa Claus. Fat and happy. So, if you are overweight, start laughing quickly. Because fat people are miserable, double whammy, and you die. Even skinny people are miserable, liable to die. So if you do want to have a burger tonight, do a lot of laughing and it will compensate for the fat in the burger. But going back to depression and other stuff like that, telling people that there's much to enjoy with depression. Enjoy it. Make much out of it. People pamper you. All your friends come and visit you. And after a while, many of my students start to enjoy depression. In fact, once they recover, they just stay depressed for a little bit longer just to enjoy the peace and the happiness. In other words, what you're doing psychologically is you're changing your attitude towards these things. And of course, as soon as you start enjoying depression, it's not depressed anymore. It's a very simple, which as a monk I've understood for a long time, that some of the world you can't change, but what you can always change is your attitude to things. So no matter what happens, whatever happens to you in your life, don't allow anything to control your happiness. That's your personal responsibility. So if somebody cheats you, if somebody hurts you, they can take away just even your health, but they don't have to take away your happiness. They can call you all sorts of names. And as I was taught when I was young, in a place like Thailand, there's one person here from Ubon, in Thailand, where I learned my skill as a monk. I was taught by my teacher, if somebody calls you a dog, which is the worst thing they could call anyone, in Asia, call you a dog. If anyone calls you a dog, he said, look at your bottom and see if you've got a tail. If you haven't got a tail, you're not a dog. End of problem. So why is it that people get unhappy when they do call you a dog? It is because you believe they may be right. But if you know you're not a dog, then what's the problem? Why do you allow what people say to upset you? And on that, there was a story at that time, because not far from the monastery where I started training, there was a US Air Force base. It was the time of the Vietnam War. And we liked hearing about a story of an African-American soldier who was going from the Air Force base into town, I'm not quite sure what reason, and had gone into town on a cycle rickshaw. And halfway on the journey, that the rickshaw passed a roadside bar where many of the rickshaw driver's friends were drinking Mekong whiskey, the local alcohol. They were getting drunk. And these drunken rickshaw drivers, they looked at their friend whose passenger was an African American, and they pointed out saying, where are you taking that dirty dog to? Now some of the GIs, the American soldiers, had learned how to speak the local language. So the driver was very concerned. This was a big guy, And if he knew that he was being called a dirty dog, this would be a fight and many people would get hurt. But the American soldier was just looking at the scenery, just enjoying the peaceful warm afternoon. So the driver thought, this guy doesn't understand the local language, and so said in Thai, actually in Pasa Isan, that's the local language, he said, I am taking this dirty dog and throwing him in the river. He needs a wash. And everybody laughed, whereas the soldier just looked around smiling. When they got to town, the soldier got out of the rickshaw and walked away without paying. And the driver shouted out, hey, you haven't paid your fare yet. And the African-American soldier turned around and said in perfect Thai or Lao, in the perfect language, dogs don't have any money. Now that's the way we should deal with abuse. You can always use it to your advantage. And this is how we can use what today is called like cognitive therapy. In other words, changing the way you look at things in order to create happiness in the most amazing, unlikely circumstances. You know, if you've got cancer, if you have depression, many of those problems come, if we're depressed, we get depressed about being depressed. And it becomes a spiral which takes us deeper and deeper and deeper into problems. So, there are some great little stories to know how to deal with problems in life. If you do have a problem, say with a cancer, or with you've lost your job, or you've lost your boyfriend or girlfriend or whatever it is, why be unhappy? Once, there was a king many years ago who went out hunting. When he was out hunting, he cut his finger. There was a doctor in his entourage. And he called the doctor over. Doctor, I've cut my finger. Have a look at it. And the doctor took a quick look, just did a superficial clean, put a band-aid on, and the king carried on with his hunting. But when he got back to the palace, he had to call the doctor over because the wound had got infected. His finger had swelled and got red. And so the doctor had to clean up the wound, put some ointment on and a new bandage. And the king asked the doctor, is my finger going to be okay? And the doctor replied, don't know. Good? Bad? Who knows? And that wasn't very reassuring. If you go and see a doctor and you say, is this infection okay? And he says, good? Bad? Who knows? Would you trust such a doctor? But anyway, that's what the doctor said. Good, bad, who knows? And a few days later, the finger was so infected, the doctor had no choice but to amputate it. And the king was very upset. So upset that he put the doctor in jail. And he locked the cell door himself. You stupid doctor. You can't even help with this little finger, and I've lost it because of your incompetence. What do you think about being in jail? And the doctor said, being in jail? Good? Bad? Who knows? So they put the doctor in jail, and a couple of weeks later, when the wound had healed, the king was out hunting again. And on this occasion, he was following some animal in the forest, chasing it at full speed on his horse, and he got separated from all the other people in the party. And being separated, he got lost in the forest. And he wandered around in the forest, not knowing which way to go home. They didn't have a GPS in those days. and going home, trying to find his way home, wandering deeper and deeper in the jungle, he wandered into the area where the indigenous people lived. He got captured by those indigenous people because that was the holiest day of their year. And in that tribe, they would always, on that holiest day of the year, do a sacrifice for their god, usually an animal sacrifice. Now they had a human sacrifice, and not just an ordinary human sacrifice. They were going to sacrifice a king. What a great gift to their god. This would mean great luck and prosperity for their tribe. So they're all very excited. And they took the poor king to a clearing in the forest. They tied him to a tree. All the indigenous people started beating their drums. This is visual effects, because that's all I've got. And they started dancing and chanting. And they were about. I tried my best, you know, I never trained in music. And they were just about to cut his throat with a sacrificial knife when one of their priests shouted, "Stop! Stop! That man has only got 9 fingers. He's not perfect enough to give as a sacrifice to our God. If you give any gifts to people you love and care for, doesn't it have to be perfect? Arunika, you are feeding me. I'm sure that your family would say, oh, if it's a guest, all the food has to be perfect. If you make me toast in the morning and your husband burns the toast, you wouldn't give it to me, would you?"
You'd probably give it to your husband.
"But if it's to someone you respect, you give the very best. If it's to a god, it has to be the very best. And giving an imperfect gift would be bad luck." So they had no choice. They had to untie the king and set him free and take him back to where he lived in the palace. And as they took him back to the palace, the king realized that having lost a finger had saved his life. And he realized that doctor was wise. He thought losing a finger was bad, but it turned out to have saved his life. So as soon as he got back into the palace, he went to the dungeons, he unlocked the cell door, told the doctor what had happened, and apologized. "I'm terribly sorry, doctor, you know, for throwing you in the jail. And I never realized your great wisdom. I thought losing a finger was bad, but it was good. It saved my life. But I'm sorry to put you in jail." And the doctor said, "Don't you remember? When you put me in jail, you asked what I felt like being in jail. And I said, being in jail, good, bad, who knows? No need to apologize. It was good that you put me in jail. Because if you hadn't put me in jail, I would have been with you on that hunt. I would have been captured, and I've got 10 fingers." And the moral of that story is, whatever happens to you in life, don't get upset. Don't get angry, because whatever happens, good, bad, who knows? When I was 19, I fell in love. A beautiful girl, and we were so happy together until she met someone else and dumped me. Was that bad? No, it was good. Otherwise, I could never become a monk. Thank you, girlfriend, for dumping me. So please remember, whatever happens to you in life, don't get angry, don't get upset, because in life you don't know how it will all turn out. And often what you think is a great tragedy, what you think is unfair and cruel, if the right attitude, you can turn it around and you will understand the great wisdom. Whatever happens in life, good, bad, who knows? Many difficult situations, you can turn around to your advantage and become really, really, really benefited from what happened. One of the key stories about happiness and how to deal with the difficulties in life and turn them into happiness is the story of walking home after a talk like this. And as you walk home, this is my first day in Halifax. I don't know what Halifax is really like, but in most cities they have lots of dogs. You take the dogs for a walk in the morning and the afternoon, and sometimes the dogs do their business on the street. Have you ever trodden in the dog poo? So this is a simile of having gone to a lovely talk like this, and when you walk home, you tread in the dog shit. What do you do when you tread in dog shit? And anyone who's a bit upset that you think a Buddhist monk should not use the S-H-I-T word, the Buddha taught, this is my teacher, the Buddha, he taught, wherever you go, you must always teach in the local language. And this is Canada. So he trod on the dog shit, okay? So a person on the way home, they tread in the dog shit. Now, if you're wise, my advice to you, please remember this, it's important. If you do tread in dog shit, do not scrape it off your shoes. Keep it. And take it home with you. And scrape it off in your garden under the apple tree. Because you will find 1 year later that your apples would be more plentiful, more sweet, more juicy than ever before. And when you eat that apple, when you bite into it, and it's so sweet and the juice drips down your cheek, please remember what you are really eating. It's dog shit that you are eating, but now transformed into juicy apple. Now I'm sure that you figured out the meaning of that simile. In the difficulties and problems which we all face in life, too often we say, this is bad, this is bad, this is bad, and we try to get rid of it. Instead, we say, good, bad, who knows? And then, whatever is really hard to bear, painful difficulty, we regard that as the dog shit. Smelly, offensive. No one really likes to tread in dog shit. If you see someone on the way home, you don't just jump into it on purpose. Unless you're weird. But you realize it's important. You know, you don't tread on purpose. Just, you know, they say that some... No, I can't say that. I better be careful. I was going to use Winston Churchill's analogy. You know, some people tread in dog shit. Some people are born with dog shit. Some people have dog shit thrust upon them. Sometimes that's in life, isn't it? You don't deserve it, but here it comes. Anyway, sometimes you are born in it. But when we have an attitude, we can transform it. Acceptance, digging it in, and transformation. Because that's what happens with life. All those experiences, we can transform it into something which creates delicious apple, beautiful gardens, beautiful flowers of compassion, fruits of wisdom. That's what happens when we have dog shit. This is one of the reasons why, when anything bad happens to you, don't get upset, don't sacrifice your happiness. don't sort of get miserable. Then you know that makes it much worse. Instead, when something happens to you, whoopee! More dog shit for my apple tree. So you can see some of these changes which we have to the way we look at things can actually change our whole life. And it's not very hard to be able to employ some of these teachings. I know that talking earlier, you know, with the psychology department leaders here, that there's so much problems in our modern world, so much difficulty, so much stress, although in a beautiful city like Halifax, I don't know why you have psychologists here, because it's a very beautiful city. It should be pretty stress-free. How can you make unhappiness and stress in a place like Halifax? But nevertheless, I'm sure there's always aspirations, goals, and hopes which sometimes don't manifest. And sometimes, some years ago when I was in Singapore, somebody asked me, said, look, I'm very busy. That's what they're like in Singapore, really busy. And they said, look, I haven't got much time, so can you please explain Buddhism to me? And sometimes we start with Buddhism with the opposite of happiness, suffering. And so I said, well, look, you know, the problems in life, the suffering, is asking from life something it can never give you. And actually, wisdom and happiness is understanding just what life can give you and enjoying that and not asking for anything more. Asking for something which life can't give you is a cause of unhappiness and suffering. So, you know, and Arunika, you got your daughter. I'm sure you want many, many things from her. But, you know, she's her own girl, so you can't ask for what she can't give you. She won't be like you. She'll be her own girl. And maybe she's doing well at school, but be kind to her, because sometimes people always want their children to be in the top 50% at school. But, you know, only half of the kids at school could be in the top 50%. As long as it's somebody else's kid, not mine. And indeed, I know some of you, how many of you are Buddhists here? Oh, okay, you Buddhists. Those of you who are Buddhists, if your kid comes in the top 10% at school, or the bottom 10% at school, you are not good Buddhist parents. Shame on you. Because in Buddhism, we believe in the middle way. Middle way is the best. You don't need to sort of be in the top 5% or 10% or the bottom 10%. And anyway, I know this is a university. And I know that, you know, you always have these exams. Remember, in life, you always have to keep passing exams. And every time you pass an exam, there's always one coming up next year. Until eventually you fail exams, and then you don't have any more. So fail an exam early on in your life, and then you're free. Parents hate me for saying that. But the most important thing is to, you know, try and not ask too much out of yourself and other people. It's what I call lowering your expectations. And I've been teaching that for such a long time. Lowering expectations is the cause of happiness. That, you know, I've now seen it's been taken up by Harvard Business School. And a lot of that stuff, actually, I know where it comes from. Because if you have high expectations of yourself and high expectations of others, and especially high expectations of your company in business, you tend to push and you ask from yourself, you ask from your loved ones, you ask from your company, things which it can never give you. And it's asking for problems, asking for suffering. So lower your expectations. And especially, lower your expectations, not too far. If you're a monk, you know, a Buddhist, you're not really in the world, you lower your expectations to absolute zero. I don't expect anything. That's why everything is a great surprise and a great benefit and great happiness. Because as a monk, you know, you give up everything. So what do you expect? Nothing. So that's why when sometimes people look at me and say, Ajahn Brahm, how much money do you earn? Nothing. How much money do you have in the bank for your retirement? Nothing. How many assets do you own? Nothing. And they say, you're a loser, Ajahn Brahm. I say, yes, I'm a loser. I've lost all my attachments. It's great being a loser. Do you want to be a winner or a loser? Sometimes I like being loser. Loser is much more freedom, much more happiness. If you lose a race, you don't have to do another one. If you're a winner, you always have to have more problems, always trying to beat your personal best. For me, I don't like PBs, I like PWs, personal worsts. And I try and beat my personal worst. My personal worst joke. You know I like telling jokes every now and again, for those of you who watch me on YouTube. And you know some of those jokes are really, really down there in the bottom of the heap. This is my latest really bad joke. There were two old men. These two old men in their 80s would meet in the local park, you know, every day, just for friendship, to talk about old stories, you know, make up a few lies, just to chat to each other. And one day, one of those men didn't turn up, and his friend thought, oh, he's really, must be sick, must be something wrong with him. But when he didn't turn up for another week, he thought, well, he must have died. And so he was very sad he'd lost one of his best friends, but he still went to the park anyway. And after 30 days, after a month, his friend turned up again. And he said, oh, I thought you were dead. I'm so happy that you are here again. I really missed you. What happened to you? And his friend said, I went to jail. Went to jail? How old are you? I'm 86, he said, and I went to jail. What happened? He said, well, you know that that lady who serves us coffee in the coffee shop we go to sometimes? She accused me of rape. And I had to go to court. And when I heard the accusation of rape and the judge asked me, how do you plead? I was so flattered, I decided to plead guilty. And the judge gave me 30 days for lying in court. If you're an old guy, you can understand flattery. But every time you tell a funny story, you don't expect anything. And that's just like in life, learning how just to lower expectations of life to what's really possible. Now, we do get sick. Sometimes we die, sometimes we get better. My teacher, when I got sick once, I got sick many times, but not so often these days. Well, I got sick with typhus fever in hospital, and my master came up to me when I was in hospital. You know, he felt terrible, about 2 or 3 weeks in this terrible, terrible fever. No one knew really what it was. In a third world hospital. And I always remember the nurse in this hospital, because they didn't know what I had. And you know, they were giving me injections twice a day, you know, in the bum. And in those days, we didn't have these, you know, one-use needles. The needles were always recycled. No, they were supposed to be sterilized, boiled, and then used again, and again, and again, because it was a poor country. So I'm pretty sure that it was right. They would use them in Bangkok, first of all, and then they send them up to the provinces. And they use them up in the provinces, and then last of all, they use them on the monks, because we were the tough guys. And this is no exaggeration. Those needles were really blunt. So you were never injected. This nurse, who was built like a water buffalo, She would take the syringe and bang it into your bottom. And that really hurt. And it, with all of the, I was supposed to be compassionate as a monk. That's what people tell you, be compassionate. But not to that nurse, no way. She hurt me. And after about 3 weeks of that, 2 or 3 weeks of that, my teacher, this great monk, Ajahn Chah, he came to see me. And you're just so uplifted, so happy to, you know, see your teacher. And he came up to my bedside, and I was just so touched he visited me. And then he said to me, he said, Brahma Wangso, you will either get better or you'll die. And he left. He had no bedside manner at all. But you can't blame him, it's so true. You get better or you die, so what's the problem? So it was teachings like that and funny stories like that which actually taught me. It's just the attitude to these things which causes you the suffering in life. Change the attitude, don't expect so much. And also understand that some of the difficulties in life, they're really important. They're the dog shit. But not just the dog shit. The dog shit is important in life. Without it, you know, we've just got no fertilizer. No way we can grow in kindness. No way we can grow in wisdom. And it's important. It saves our lives. But when I was a teacher, you know, I had to set my first examination in school. I don't like exams. You know, in Cambridge University, where I, you know, learnt my physics, I remember they had graffiti on the walls, and what, there's many graffiti I saw there, and there was always very, very, almost inspiring. It was great social comment. And one of the graffiti on the wall of Cambridge was, "Exams kill by degrees." It was true, because I know you, many people from the university here, you know, when you have to pass an exam, you can't teach what you really want. You have to teach people how to pass, you know, which, you know, is restricting just this beautiful aspect of human nature which wants to explore and discover and forget about the examinations. You just want the freedom just to learn, to know, to explore the world in ways which may be not examinable. But nevertheless, exams kill by degrees. But I do sort of remember those times, and they were very, very wonderful times. But when I became a teacher and had to set an exam myself, I didn't really know what to do. And one of the senior teachers, there was an examination in math. And one of the senior teachers there, I said, "What should I do? How can I set an exam?" And he said, "Aim for 70%. Because if you make the examination too easy, and everyone gets 90, 95%. You know, what's the point of that? The exam is too easy, it's got no purpose. If the examination is too hard and the average score is maybe 30, 40%, that will mean that your students will lose their motivation. They will think they can't do math and they will probably give it up. But if you set the average score to be 70%, then most of your students, you know, will be encouraged. And it's a good success rate. And they will think, yeah, I can do maths, they will continue on. And the 30% where they fail, that's important because you as their teacher can see their weak points, what they did not understand in your lessons. And so you can address their weak points in the next couple of lessons. That's why you want just about 30% failure, 70% success. And I understood from that little anecdote that the 70% rule applies throughout the whole of your life. If you're 100% healthy in your life and you never get sick, you learn nothing. If you're always sick, and again, that's just too hard to bear, but a little bit, 30% of sickness every now and again, a little bit of cancer every now and again. I'm saying this, I know what I'm saying, it's important. A little bit of sickness every now and again is where you learn and grow. A little bit of failure every now and again is where you learn and grow. So, having said that, if you've got a husband who is 100% perfect, dump him and get another one. You learn. The best husband is 70%, okay, not 100%. And the best wife? 70%. Because we always want the very, very best. Now, I know there's a few young people here that may be still looking for their partners in life. Look, take my advice. You know, if you want a partner in life, girls, never, ever marry a rich guy. If you marry a wealthy man, then later on in his life, I'm sure this happens, even here in Halifax. Later on in life, he'll get a mistress. Because he can afford one. But if you marry a poor guy, you know, he can't afford a mistress. No girl will go out with a guy if he's not rich. You know the saying, no money, no honey. You've heard that one before. So if you marry a poor guy, you've got him for life. No trouble, no worries. The same you guys. You're really stupid marrying beautiful girls. If you marry a really attractive girl, you'll be jealous for the rest of your life. Other guys will look at her and want her. But if you marry an ugly girl, then she's yours for life. You can go overseas for 2 or 3 weeks. You've got nothing to worry about. Because no one else wants her. So if you want a happy marriage, girls marry poor guys. Guys marry ugly girls. And you'll be happy forever. Doesn't that make sense? Don't you want to be happy? So all you girls, if you're too beautiful, go to ugly parlor, not beauty parlor. And all you boys, if you're too wealthy, the donation box is over there. It never works, but I try. So as a monk, you always sort of see things in a totally different way. One of the nice things about being a monk is because you live outside the box, you actually do think outside the box, which is one of the reasons you can see all these things. How many of you are unhappy because you've got too much work to do? How many of you are stressed? No. Yeah. Okay, you're the honest ones. The ones who didn't put their hands up are the dishonest ones because you're stressed out too. Now, Arunika just read out, you know, all the stuff and duties. That's not all of it. I've got many more duties than that, many more organizations which I look after. Actually, I don't call it organizations these days. I call it franchises. I've got Ajahn Brahm Society in Sri Lanka. I've got the Bodhinyana International. That's my monastery, Bodhinyana, in Hong Kong. The Brahm Education Society, Brahm Center. In Singapore, I've got Ehi Pasago Foundation, which does all my books in Indonesia. I call it my franchises, Mac Brahms. But, you know, you look after a lot of people. But do I look stressed? Even though I work really hard. And I'll tell you the secret. And I told this many, many times. And I'm really pleased every now and again, some of the stories which I invent, some of the exercises which I start, go round and round, and then somebody comes and tells it to me. The local mayor of our city of Perth came to a function some time ago, and I was in attendance, sitting in the audience, and in her little speech she said, "A wise man told me this story." And I know where that came from. It came from me to another, to another, to another, to another. And it was a simile of how heavy is a glass of water. I teach this in business schools. And this has actually got on Harvard Business School blog again. It goes around and around. This is how to be happy, even though you do lots and lots of work. How heavy is my glass of water? Actually, I told this once at Imperial College in London. They're all engineers there. And this smart ass came up and said about 200 grams. Now it's probably actually accurate, but that's not what I meant. How heavy is a glass of water? And I say, look, the longer I hold it, the heavier it feels. After 30 seconds, I'll start to ache. After 1 minute, I'll be in pain. After 2 minutes of holding this glass of water, I will be in agony and a very, very stupid monk. What should I do when this gets too heavy to hold comfortably? Put it down, for goodness sake. Put it down for maybe 1 minute, that's all. And if you don't believe me, you can try this at home. After 1 minute, you pick it up again. Yeah, honestly, it feels much lighter. It's comfortable to hold again. The meaning of this simile is, when you work, when your job gets too heavy to hold comfortably, what do? You just keep on pushing through. keep on at the computer, keep on trying to work at the project, keep on trying to study at home. You see, kids on the computer till 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night. When you're tired, it's very uncomfortable, you stress out, and also you lose your productivity. Now, whatever you write, whatever you do, it's always really slow, the words don't come out, the ideas just dry up, and you know, your productivity goes way down. But imagine if, when you get tired at work, you put it down and rest for a few minutes. You say, I have got no time, there is a deadline, I have to complete this project. If there's no time, then you have to go slowly. If you go fast, you don't produce. You rest for 5 or 10 minutes, and you find those 5 or 10 minutes of rest, putting down the cup, when you go back to the project afterwards, it's very light, and you can produce, ideas come up. It's just basic neuroscience. Your brain cannot keep working at that level for too long. You do need to rest. When you were at school, you had recess. You went kick a football around or something in the morning, in lunchtime and afternoon. And I really want modern business to reintroduce playtime. Imagine you get the executives, a middle management, everybody, in the morning, you know, at Microsoft, the bell goes ding, 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 and everyone has to leave their office and play. And after play, go back to work after 10 or 15 minutes. I guarantee their profits will go up, and the stress will go down, and the ideas will start to increase. Because in that time, you're resting your brain. You're putting the cup down, which means 10 or 15 minutes spent meditating, putting it down, playing, whatever you wish to do, call it. 15 minutes of rest, you make up afterwards getting 3 hours work done in two of much higher quality. And if you don't do that, you'll find that because you stress out, because you are tired, when you get home, you take it out on your family. When you get home, you know, you are so tired, you know, you lost your resilience, which means that you get angry, your family life just goes down in quality, and you eventually get sick. So when you're tired, take a rest. And don't ever think you are wasting the time. You haven't got time to rest. If you have got not much time, you've got no choice, but you have to rest to increase your efficiency. And Harvard Business School calls it an investment. You know business, they like investment. An investment of time. 5 or 10 minutes resting increases the productivity of your brain. And you know, most anger and even family problems in today's world, they all begin because people work so hard, they're so tired, they lost their resilience, and they get angry at the people they love. And why do they do that? It's rotten when people you love, you're committed to, you get upset at them. I love telling the story of the husband who came home from work, the sort of husband who gets stressed out, who works so hard, you know, to try and get enough money, you know, to have a nice house, give his kid a good education and put a bit aside for later on. Worked so hard he came home late. And his 6-year-old child was waiting for him. And his 6-year-old son, as soon as daddy came in the door, said, "Daddy, daddy, how much do you earn at work?" And the daddy said, "Look, be quiet, son, I'm too tired." "Daddy, how many dollars do you earn at work?" "Look, I told you, son, I'm tired, it's nothing to do with you." "Daddy, how much dollars do you earn per hour?" "Look, I told you, I'm tired. It's nothing to do with you. I told you 3 times. You're grounded. Go to your room." And so the poor little son, I'm trying to get, was that anger convincing? Really, I've got no practice. I must practice more. So the son went to his room, and the father, after he had a cup of coffee and just relaxed a little bit, he realized that he'd shouted at his own son unnecessarily, just because he was tired. When he's tired, he gets grumpy and angry. So he went to his son's room and apologized, said, "Sorry, son, I shouldn't have shouted at you like that. And I don't know why you want to know, but actually, I earn $20 an hour at work." And the son smiled and said, "Thank you so much, Daddy. Can I please borrow $10? And the father would usually get angry again, but he thought, "Oh, crikey, I've already got angry once to my son, so I can't get angry again." And so he bit his lip, opened up his wallet, and gave $10 to his son. And his son smiled again and said, "Thank you so much, Daddy." And he took the $10 bill, opened up the drawer in the table next to his bed, and got out another $10 in coins, counted out a full 20, and gave it to his father, saying, "Now, Father, can I please have 1 hour of your time?" I was told that story, and some people cry, because it's so true in our modern world. Why is it the kid has to pay $20 because that's how much his father costs, $20 per hour? What's most important in life? Your kids need you, your wife needs you, your husband needs you. So that's the most important thing. And investment of time in yourself, in your family. Now, recently, one of our members, who's really sort of knows what he's doing in IT, attended the conference, a big conference in Silicon Valley. I think it was called Wisdom 101 or something. You know, with all the sort of the leaders of Microsoft, PayPal, Google, and everyone attending there. And the theme of the conference, the title was "Disconnect to Connect." It's such a beautiful title because all these innovators in Silicon Valley was realizing that we're connected to our devices so much we've disconnected from the people we love and care for. We've disconnected from ourselves as well. So that's a huge problem. So if you want to connect with your family, the people you love and care for, you have to turn off those phones, get away from the computers, and connect. And also to connect with oneself as well, for the sake of happiness. Disconnect to connect. And I often say, "Thank you so much for turning off your mobile phones." Because I usually use the saying that, you know, if a mobile phone goes off during one of my talks, that's, you know, I use, you know, Buddhist ideas. I say, that's bad karma for your phone. And because of the bad karma of interfering with one of my talks, in its next life, your mobile phone will be reborn as a parking meter, which is the lowest form of life for machines. But can't we sort of disconnect a little bit? And also disconnect from our wants and our hopes. Because when we put things down, when we can rest, we can enjoy ourselves. And we get so much done when we learn how to let go. We are empowering our brains, giving it energy. And that's what happiness does. Happiness is an important, I said, the health by expanding your blood vessels. It also makes your brain much more productive. So those people who are depressed, I go back to depression again, those people who are stressed out, those people who are having a hard time, you know, one of the other ways of creating happiness is exercise. Do you exercise? For those of you who haven't got time to exercise, or it's sometimes maybe February and March in Halifax, it's too cold to go out running, you can do Ajahn Brahm's 20 push-ups every morning. I do my 20 push-ups every morning. You know my push-ups? You stand in front of the mirror in your bathroom. Okay, you can all join in now, it's very easy. Take your two fingers, put them in the side of the mouth, and push up. One, two, three, four, five, six. Do 20 push-ups every morning, and you will find it exercises your smiling muscles. How can you expect to smile when you've done no exercise? How can you expect to run for the bus if you haven't sort of done some running before? You need to exercise and exercise your smiley muscles. You know, one of my problems these days is after the talks, I don't know why people like to take photos of me. You know, I'm 63, I'm old, I'm ugly, I'm bald. I don't know why people like to take photographs of me, but they do, and every time they take a photograph, I have to smile. And I can do this, you know, for hours because I've trained. I do my 20 push-ups every morning. And when I do 20 push-ups every morning, the muscles are very strong now. So anyone who's upset, anyone who's having a hard time, anyone's had some bad news, you got cancer, you've got some, lost your job, lost your tenure, whatever it is, failed your exams, go to the bathroom and try 20 push-ups. Simple, but it works. So what this is all about is, I meant to get onto this, I'm just going round and round on this talk, but it is like learning the importance of happiness and sometimes understanding that, you know, happiness is not something you do, it's just something you see when you change the way you look at life. You get criticized and you turn it to your advantage. I never allow anyone to control my happiness. My happiness is my own business. And whether you get cancer, whether you get disappointments, whether you lose your finger, good, bad, who knows? See what happens. If the plane gets delayed, well, there's always another plane coming later on. See what happens. Good, bad, who knows? There's always, the reason I actually came here, you know, Arunika, I think I told you, was, you know, I was supposed to go to Germany to teach a retreat. I booked the ticket very early because it was cheap and the retreat got cancelled. Was that good, bad? Who knows? I didn't know what it was, but because it got cancelled, I had a ticket to London, so I, well, I might as well come here. So this is what happens. So never think that the things which happen to you in life are terrible. You know you're out of control. Life is out of control. Your job is just to make the best out of it. Turn the shit into apples. And just when you look at yourself in the mirror every morning and you just do this stupid 20 push-ups in the morning, you can never take yourself seriously. You can never take life that seriously. You know, life is just this wonderful thing you can laugh at and be happy about. And all the difficulties and problems in life, I'm talking about the big ones. I'm going to tell you more about that in the talk tomorrow about forgiveness and how you really just take, you know, some of these people I have to deal with who've been raped and tortured. Big stuff. You know, I tell the same thing to them. At first they think, you don't know what you're talking about, but it works. What you're doing is you're being aware of life and you're being kind to it. But I said earlier that, you know, you've all probably heard that just the latest fad about mindfulness in psychology, being aware, but that's not good enough. You know, as a Buddhist, I've trained in meditation for so many years. Now I've added kindness to the mindfulness. So these days I call it kindfulness. A little difference, just saying this little first letter, M to K, kindfulness. So you're aware of life and you are kind to it. Kind to yourself, kind to the dog shit, kind to the cancer. And that changes just the whole attitude you have. You're kind to life instead of always trying to fight it and get rid of the stuff you don't like. Be kind to life. Be kind to old age. I'm getting old now. I said I was 63. But there's a lot of benefits in getting old. You know, one of the benefits of getting old, I just told this to someone just before the talk. I've noticed this in life, that when you get, you know, past 60, you know, your eyes start to get weak, you have to wear glasses. You know, when you're about 70, you probably have to wear hearing aids, if not before. Your eyes go, your ears go, you know, your legs are not as strong as they used to be. And even your hands sometimes shake. You know, you lose all those parts, they all get weaker and weaker. But there's one part of the body which gets stronger with age. And that is your mouth. old people can talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. Isn't that true? That's why, you know, you have to be at least 50 to be a politician. Because it gets older when you get stronger when you get old. So there's always some benefits in life. There's always something to sort of look forward to. So that way, the happiness is just changing your attitude towards life. A bit of kindfulness towards life, kindfulness towards your body. And in other talks I'm going to give here, there's another four, three to go, I'm going to expand on that, how kindfulness can heal a lot of stuff in your body, how kindfulness to your past can forgive the past and let it go and so you can be free, how kindfulness can actually repair some of the relationship problems we have. I don't know why boys and girls can't live together while they keep, you know, fighting with each other. Now, these are people you love and care for. Can't you be kind to them and just forgive and let go? Let's come in tomorrow. But for today, thank you for listening. Now's the time for some questions. So who's going to ask the first question? Okay. So no hands are going straight up. So I'm going to tell a little story to try and get the first question. Oh, you got a question there? Okay. Because, no, this is a little bit of Buddhism. I know there's people from many different religions here. But you know that Buddhism, we believe in reincarnation and karma and stuff. And so, once, you know, the Buddha was actually asked, he said, why is it that some people are born with the ability to create wealth and some people are, you know, always poor? They said, what did you do in your past life? You know, that even if you work really hard, you know, your business, you know, your life, there's always debts come in and it's so hard to make ends meet. Why are some people poor and why other people are rich? And nothing to do with how hard you work, because you know there's many people here work really hard, and some other people, they hardly work at all, and just money comes to them. So actually the Buddha said, because of this type of karma in their previous life, they're wealthy or they're rich now. And it was such a good answer that the man asked a second question. He said, why is it that some people are beautiful while other people are ugly? And you may have noticed, when I mentioned the word ugly in particular, I looked at the floor. Because when I told this story once in Singapore, I just happened by chance to be looking at one woman when I mentioned the word ugly. And my goodness, did she complain. Why did you mention the word ugly when you were looking at me, Ajahn Brahm? So now I look at the floor when I tell this. And so the Buddha gave the idea in karma, what karma you did in your past life to be reborn ugly in this life. And actually, for the sake of interest, the Buddha said that if you get angry in this life, you get ugly in your next life. So don't get angry, otherwise you're going to get ugly. But remember, if you are an ugly girl, you get a good boyfriend. But anyway, so he gave the answer. But then the next question was why I tell this story. He said, why is it that some people are born intelligent? You know, they can get through school and get through university just so easily, while other people have to work so hard, even getting extra tuition, and even they work really hard and still it's hard to pass. What is a karmic cause for intelligence and a karmic cause of stupidity? And this is true, this is in the Chulakamma Vibhanga Sutra, the Buddha said, the karmic reason for stupidity in your next life is because you don't ask questions in this life. Any questions? I always get lots of questions after that.
I do have a question.
Yeah, okay. You are going to be very intelligent, a professor in Dalhousie for next.
Maybe so. So, of course, it would be lovely if we all were able to have 30% sickness and 70% health in our lives, right? And you're talking about karma and how things don't always turn out so balanced. And I work with some people who have more like 90% sickness and horrible pain and unpleasantness and suffering, and really don't seem to have the karmic gift of being able to work with it such that they find the apple tree, such that they can make an apple out of it. And I'm just wondering if there's anything that you say to people who wind up with that type of karma, where it's just 90% awfulness, and there isn't enough, there isn't the karma there for them to be able to really make something of it.
Okay, there is the karma there when they meet people, like you, who can actually help them. And a lot of times, I'm not quite sure the sort of people you're dealing with, whether it's chronic pain, or whether it's just a chronic sickness, or just a lot of disappointment in their life.
Would it be helpful to know?
Yeah, go on, yeah.
I'm thinking of people with really, really bad PTSD, where their life has been just repetitive, horrific trauma, and now their brain is torturing them.
Okay, the brain doesn't torture them because when they have... I was going to mention this story tomorrow, but as it's come up now, post-traumatic stress. I did allude to that. One of the organizations I support in Australia, the Australian Society for the Survivors of Torture and Trauma. Because we all have a lot of migrants come into these countries like Canada and Australia, and it's wonderful we can welcome them. And some of the people have been through absolutely horrific stuff, multiple rapes, torture, and these dungeons in the world, maybe because of their political views or just being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Stuff which makes your skin crawl, creep, you know, just what happened to them. And so one of the things which, you know, I tell them, I remember the head of this unit in Perth said there's four stories which she uses from me. She said, which work? She said she got her authority to run this center from the university, but the practical stuff she all learned from me. And one of them is, you know, the story from which the title of the first book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, came from. It's when I go through that story, it takes a little bit of a while, but it's worth it. When as a 13-year-old child, I was told by my father, he took me aside in his beat-up old car, and he said to me, son, I need to tell you this. Now, wherever you go in your life, whatever you do, however you turn out, good or bad, please always remember the door of my house, your father's house, will always be open to you. And I knew it was important, but I never really understood it until much later. Because he didn't mean the poor council flat, the government-subsidized housing in which I grew up. He meant the door of his heart was always open to me, no matter what ever happened to me. And it was that unconditional aspect of that love and acceptance which was so crucial. That's how I learned to love other people, but also myself. So, survivors of torture and trauma, people have really gone through hell and managed to physically survive, but are mentally traumatized. I tell them to just imagine that in their heart region there's a little heart, and I tell them just don't have to know what a real heart looks like. Look like the hearts you see in the Valentine's Day cards, you know, just the hearts you see on the playing cards. That type. Imagine that in your chest. And imagine two big doors, double door, opening up. And a little staircase coming down, like in the old aircraft, coming down to the ground. And on the bottom of that staircase is all those yous, the people you have been, who have experienced such torture, such abuse, such unfair and painful treatment. they're all down outside of your heart, rejected. And now you invite them in. And you imagine them, that person who was in the dungeon being tortured, that little girl who was abused by a family member, that little frightened, terrified, but also lonely being. Invite them up. And you imagine them walking up these stairs. And there's the other part of you at the top. And you embrace. You hug, you cry. Come into my heart. Because the problem with trauma is that we reject it. We try and keep it out. We try to cure it rather than caring for it. And that's incredibly powerful. You can't get rid of what happened to you. That's a problem, trying to blot it out, trying to reject it, trying to find some way that it never happened. Instead, you embrace it, and it comes into you. And it's a great transformation happens. So much so, I like telling the story of one of these, I was going to say poor girls, but I stopped myself because she would get upset at me if I said that. One of these women who had been multiply raped, and she went through this process. And when she was telling somebody, the person said, "Oh, that's terrible, what happened to you?" And she scolded that guy. It was, "How can you say that? It's made me who I am. It's me." And she had totally embraced it. And it was incredible to see just how that transformation could happen. You have to open the door of your heart, no matter what it is. It's who you are. It's keeping it out is the problem to the trauma and torture. And it's really, really powerful stuff. And, you know, there's a few other little stories, but what's one of the most important ones? I'll tell the other story because I was telling this at a mental health conference which we had in Australia about a couple of months ago. And it was about, you know, the trees. You know, you like walking in a forest here in Nova Scotia. Apparently, you know, it's the first time I've been here, but you've got some very beautiful forests. You spend a lot of time in there, apparently. And next time you go walking in a forest, please see if you can find a perfect tree. One which is dead straight, which is not crooked, with all the branches in the right place, you know, all the leaves nice and healthy, with a smooth bark with no damage, no scars on the bark. If you can find a tree like that, it was probably planted by the government. It's not natural. It's not real. Because all trees in the forest are bent and crooked. They lean all over the place. The branches are just, you know, just, what's it called? Just all over the place. They're not straight. They're not where they're supposed to be. And the bark is always scarred and damaged. Those are the trees I like. Those are the natural trees. Those are the beautiful trees. The damaged ones. So I tell to people who, you know, in that sort of, had that sort of experience, if you're damaged goods, you belong as one of the trees in the most beautiful forests in the world. Welcome. And so people look at the damage, not as something they should get rid of, but something which makes them beautiful and lovable. You belong. Stop rejecting it. And that transforms people. Okay.
Questions?
That's what I mean by kindfulness. Yeah.
Okay. I seem to be stuck in the middle of a family situation where two members of my family both have like serious trouble with each other, and they both feel like they can only be happy once the other admitted to be in the wrong.
Okay.
And both of them, of course, feel like they're 100% right.
Yep.
And Well, there seems to be no solution.
I have a solution.
Okay.
Very easy solution. And this is not in any book because I only heard this a couple of months ago. And I don't think I've given any public talks on YouTube since then. So this is actually, those of you who are my YouTube addicts, Ajahn Brahm junkies, you haven't heard this before. Because I heard of a couple, once they get married, you know, they fell in love first of all, but once they got married, they started arguing. You know, like most people do. You can always tell how long a person's been married by how they argue with each other. Most people, this is average, okay. But for 2 years, they were always arguing with each other, you know, no one giving in, I'm right, you're wrong, no, you're wrong, I'm right. So they came up with this very innovative solution. They looked at the day of the month. If it was an even day, 2nd, 4th, 6th, 8th, 10th, 12th, then he was right. On the odd days, she was right. So they had an argument, looked up, oh, it's the 11th today, so that she was right. What day is it today? The 21st. So 21st, odd day, she must be right. The next day, he must be right. You know that really worked? They don't have any arguments for the last 8 years. So you may think that's stupid, but actually it works. Because it means, but you may have an argument, who gets the odd days and who gets the even days? Because there's more odd days in the year than there are even days. But it doesn't matter, it's just roughly equal. Suggest that to them.
Good idea. It works.
Okay,
yeah,
so you
because
can,
I've suggested so many things, but if you're kind of complicated, maybe the easy
way. Okay, so remember, odd days, she's right, even days, he's right.
Thank you so much.
They should do that in Parliament as well. Go on.
Hi. My question has to do with the precept of no lying.
No lying.
And kindfulness.
Okay. Kindfulness, good, yeah.
In the Maritimes, we're very polite here. And we often tell fibs so we don't hurt someone's feelings.
Oh, often. Yeah.
And how do you deal with that?
How to deal with that? Look, there's always a way that you can say something without lying. For example, for me, you know, I travel around so much, and many people know who I am, but sometimes I don't know who you are. And sometimes, you know, I've met you before, and so sometimes, you know, you expect me to know who you are. So when people come and they say, do you remember me? If I say no, it really hurts them. Because I've been, you know, coming to your temple for a long time. So these days, instead of telling the truth, so I don't know you at all, instead of telling a fib, I say, oh, you're the person whose name I keep forgetting. You see, so you use wise speech, you don't have to lie. You know, politicians are great on this, learn from them.
Thank you. And thank you for all your talks on YouTube.
Okay, very good. Okay, another addict.
More questions?
Yeah, because if you do tell a fib, eventually it just comes back to bite you. You know, and so sometimes, if you're smart, there's always another way you can get around it. Yeah, go on.
If your glass is full of worry...
So if your glass is full of...
If your glass is full of worry...
Worry, yeah.
Not work, but worry.
Yeah.
How do you put it down?
How do you put it down? You're very worried. One of the things is that story about good, bad, who knows. Because all worry is looking at the future, you know, with a sort of negative mind. I've lost my finger. This is terrible. But sometimes when you know life, that sometimes the mistakes which happen to you in life, they turn out to be, as they say, blessings in disguise. Do you understand? So sometimes that when we worry about these things, we don't realize that when it turns out better than we'd ever expected. We can't imagine just how a problem could turn out to be, you know, the blessings of life. And so when we worry a lot, it's looking at the future with negativity. So, you know, that title of my book, Don't Worry, Be Grumpy, is actually a combination of two stories in that book. The other one was, you know, the usual sign people say, don't worry, be happy. We can't do that. So I said, don't worry, be grumpy. But what story I did put in my book was, if you worry, it's looking at the future with negativity. What if you look at the future with a positive mind? We call that hope. So my phrase was, don't worry, be hopey. H-O-P-E-Y. You know, I like making new words, because when you make new words, and actually this word hopey has got into the urban dictionary, you know, which is a precursor to actually getting into a real dictionary. You know, what a beautiful word that is, be hopey. You know, full of hope, look at the future, not with worry, but hopey. Because hopey is looking at the future and just, you know, with a positive mind. And you will find, you know, this is psychology. If you worry about something, it's likely to happen. If you're hopey of something positive, that is likely to happen. I'm sure that you've all had experience in life. What you fear, actually you bring about. And if you have a positive mind, you bring that one about as well. Don't worry. Be hopey. Okay, now you've got another question. Come back. If you're not satisfied with the answer, please come back again.
What if the worry is the present and not the future?
The worry is the present. Well, in the present moment, you know, the old saying about a glass half empty or half full. It depends whether you're drinking or whether you're pouring. So if I've got a glass, it's my glass, and it's only up to here, then it's half empty. Come on, put some more in, please. But if I'm the one who's pouring in a restaurant, no. You know, your glass is half full, I'm not going to give any more. So that is contingent on what you want in life. And sometimes in this present moment, it's here. And sometimes you say to it, the door of my heart is presence, this moment. How I feel right now. And I make peace with it. And then it changes. This is a transformative power of kindfulness. The mindfulness bit, which I'm sure many of you know, is being aware of what's happening in the present moment. And basically I say, that's not good enough. You're aware, but it hurts like hell. Thank you very much for making the pain even worse. But the kindness transforms it. I still remember as a kid being brought up in a poor part of London, lots of migrants, and we used to play soccer, you know, in the streets. And as a 4, 5, 6-year-old, you spend so much time playing soccer. And every time you went for a tackle a bit too aggressively, you know, you'd fall on the floor, and it's the pavement, the bitumen sometimes, and you scrape the skin off your knees. And I can always remember as growing up having scabs on my knees. And as soon as I did fall over and hurt my knee and scrape some skin off, I'd run to my mummy, and she would kneel down and kiss it. She called it kissing it better. And immediately she kissed it, the pain went, every time. And also, you know, the wound healed. Put a big plaster on, no washing, no antibiotics. And I can never understand this to this day, how when you put a mouth with all these germs on an open wound, how it never gets infected. But it was because of her kindness, the love of her mother, that's all it needed. And immediately the pain went. And I remember that. I thought that was natural. I never understood science as a 6-year-old, but I remember that. And it's a power of kindness to take away pain. That's why we have nurses. At least in the old days when their main job was not to do what doctors are supposed to do and not to, you know, keep on filling out all the forms, when they had time, you know, to sit next to a patient, hold their hand, and just basically care. And it's a wonderful time, because that was so important for the health of and recovery of a person. That's why they have pet therapy, and a dog, because the dog can't fill out any forms. So it's all it's there to do is just to pat and just to lick you or whatever. So that kindness is brilliant, because that is what takes away the pain. of the present moment. So not mindfulness, kindfulness. And I'll give more examples about that later on in my talks. Some over there.
There is a small boy about 7 years old and terrified with fear of death. What would you tell him to help?
Fear of death. Depends, you know, what sort of religion they are. If they're a religion who, say, you know, believes in a heaven, then make use of that. And I tell people, suppose, I said, that a person, you know, comes to this talk and they found it sponsored by some rich organization like Arunika, and I don't know, Dalhousie, you know, she's not rich. But suppose it was sponsored by, say, Microsoft or whatever. And now, which is the biggest company in Canada? I wanted to say it's Microsoft, okay. No, let's say it's sponsored by Canada Airlines. And so Canada Airlines will give a prize to one person, you know, who comes to this talk, like a door prize. And the prize for the lucky person is a first-class flight to Paris for you and your partner or your friend. And you stay in a 6-star hotel in Paris for 2 weeks. And you get $2,000 each a day for spending anywhere you like. And you find out, sir, that you've won that prize. Would you be happy? Now, you can be honest, most people would. No, free holiday, 2 weeks to Paris or any other place you really like to go. $2,000 each to spend in the expensive shops, all expenses paid, 6-star hotel. Of course you'd be lucky. You'd be happy. And you can, in 2 weeks' time, you can go. You'd be excited. In 2 weeks, I'll be in Paris, 6-star hotel. You know, $2,000 each in the shops of Paris, you know, all these incredible, amazing places you can go and see, a free holiday. You wouldn't be able to wait. 1 week, you probably have your bags packed. 3 days to go, you know, you get really excited. The day before, you wouldn't be able to sleep at night. Tomorrow, I'm going. You'd be so excited. And sometimes, can I go earlier? Suppose you went to the doctor and he said, you've got 2 weeks to live. And you think, only 2 weeks to go to heaven. And heaven is much better than Paris, much better than going shopping. I hate going shopping. I don't know what you get out of going shopping. You know that sometimes people come to Australia from Singapore to go shopping, and the Australians go to Singapore to go shopping? There's something wrong with that. But anyway, heaven, you're going to be happy. So what are you waiting for? It's an old story of this old man and old woman been married for years and years and years. And when she died first, he was so heartbroken because he'd lost his wife. 2 days later, he died as well. I've actually seen this many times. People have been together for such a long time, when one of them dies, the other one goes pretty quickly. So because it was only 2 days, they both appeared in heaven together. And when they appeared in heaven, they were met by this angel. And the angel told them, he said, because you've been really good people. You know, there's a few pastors here. Please use this story. You've come to church. You've been really good. You've been kind and generous. So I've come to show you your eternal reward. And he took them to this mansion on the cliffs with these beautiful ocean views. You'd have to be a multimillionaire to afford a mansion like that. He said, this is your heavenly reward. And the guy, the man, said, that's all very well and good, but someone on my salary can't afford the government land tax. Do you have to pay taxes or rates on houses? The bigger the house, the more you have to pay. Imagine how much you have to pay for a mansion. He said, I can't afford this. And the angel said, "Sir, up in heaven we don't have governments. So there's no tax, it's for free." And then the angel took them inside this huge mansion. There were so many rooms with exquisite furniture. They had this chandeliers with Waterford crystal from Ireland. They had huge plasma screen TVs, you know, wider than this room. And the guy and the angel said, "I know you always like, because you're from Canada, you always like your ice hockey. In here, you can watch ice hockey. And your team, who's the Halifax team? Who's it called? The what? That something Hansa? I can't understand. But anyway, the Halifax team, always, because this is heaven, you can watch it on the plasma screen TV, they always win, and every year they get the Stanley Cup. This is heaven. You can't have your team losing. And he took them even into the toilet. The toilet was incredible. Even the toilet seat was made out of gold. And the little button you pressed to flush was a diamond. And when you flushed it, not water came out, but Chanel number 5. So this is heaven. And after going through the last room, the man said, look, you know, someone with my resources can't afford the insurance on a property like this. It's too many valuable stuff, even diamonds in the toilets. Burglars will come in here. No." And the angel said, "Look, in heaven, we don't have burglars. They're not allowed. So you don't need insurance. It's for free." And then he took them to the garage. Not a double garage, a triple garage. And in that triple garage was the biggest stretch limousine you'd ever seen in the world. It was so big it had a swimming pool inside. And the next car was one of these you know, all-terrain vehicles. It could go anywhere, not just you know, in the forests of Nova Scotia. This could go up waterfalls. And the third car was a Ferrari, a limited edition, souped up Ferrari. And the angel said to this guy, he said, "I know that in this life, you always like looking at these car magazines, drooling over your own sports car, and you never could get one. So we've decided in heaven to get you a red Ferrari sports car." And the angel looked at the man looked at the angel and said, "Look, what's the point of a sports car? You know, whenever you go fast, there's one of these policemen with a speed camera, and you get fined and your car gets impounded." And the angel said, "Sir, there are no policemen up in heaven. And you can go as fast as you like up in heaven. If you have a crash, what does it matter? You're already dead." And then he opened the garage doors. And on the opposite side of the road to his mansion was this beautiful, immaculate 18-hole golf course. And the angel said, "We knew how much you loved playing golf in the life. And it was only when you started to get sick you stopped playing. So we decided for your eternal reward to build a golf course right next to your house." And he said, "This golf course was designed by Tiger Woods himself." You know how that could be? And the guy said, "Well, Tiger Woods is not dead. How could he design this?" He said, "Don't you remember when he had his argument with his wife? He crashed his car. In that time, he had a near-death experience. He went up to heaven. We made him design a golf course before he came back again." And he said, "On this heavenly golf course, once you get the ball onto the green, it always curves into the hole. This is heaven." And the guy said, "Look, someone on my salary will never get elected to this golf club. Because, you know, in this really expensive golf club, you have to know someone who knows someone to become a member." And he said, "You're already a member, sir. Not a life member, a death member." And then he left this couple. the angel left. And as soon as the angel left, the husband started scolding his wife, started getting angry at her and really upset. And as soon as he paused for breath, his wife said, "Why are you so angry? Now you've got this incredible mansion. You can watch your ice hockey whenever you want on this huge screen. You know, you've got your Ferrari car. I know you give you an arm and a leg for the Ferrari car. You can drive as fast as you like, and you've got your golf course on the opposite side of the road. Why are you so upset?" Because, wife, if it wasn't for all that healthy food you gave me, I could have been up here many years ago. So, why are you afraid of death? Come on, bring it on. The only reason why I'm afraid of death is because we don't know what death is. If we would know about what happens after death, dying, okay, be afraid of dying because it can be quite painful and uncomfortable sometimes. But death itself, what are you afraid of? So, any of your members in church, those pastors here, just tell them, what are you afraid of? You're going to heaven. Doctor says, you've got 2 weeks to live. I say, can you make it 1 week, please? 3 days? Okay, another question.
Thank you very much for the great talk. I was wondering, you've obviously been practicing for a really long time.
Yeah.
And building and strengthening the mind, working on your paramis, and I was curious, what is your growing edge right now in your practice?
My practice at the moment is whenever I go traveling around the place, going to many cities, many countries. You know, these days it's very rare to find human beings. Apparently it's 500,000 people in Halifax, roughly. But how many human beings are there here? Most of you are human goings, human doings, not human beings. You're not being here. So my practice is becoming a human being. Not a human going, not a human doing things. Always doing too much, never being here. Always going on to the next thing. And even in meditation, people are always going on to the next experience, to the next attainment, to the next goal. And that is not Buddhist meditation. It's being here. Not going anywhere, not doing anything. Letting go of all doing, being here, and becoming still. That's the practice. Spend your whole life going places. Where do you end up? Where are you going? I'll tell you where you're going. You're going to your coffin. I'll get this out of the way, and then I'll do something. You end up, the whole life gets out of the way. You never actually you've had some enjoyment, but we've never actually been here. At least very few moments. How many of you had those experiences? You know, maybe out in the forest, just by a lake, and you just sit down there and you're not doing anything. Just enjoying, just being here. Where there's no other place you want to be. There's no jobs, you know, you're trying to finish off. There's no big list which people have ticking off this. I'll get this one done, then I'll do something else. All these jobs you have to do. All those lists get thrown away. All those things you think you have to do. All those things you have to change get put aside. You just be. You don't want to get any different. Don't want to go anywhere else. Don't want to be with anybody else. Just being content. Those are some of the most wonderful times of your life. I'm sure you can remember those times. That's what meditation is. Just being here, content, not wanting anything in the whole world. After you've rested like that, then you can go and work. But we work, and have very few moments of just being. So can we have more human beings in Halifax? Okay, next question.
Yes, yes, yes.
Do you think that in Buddhism the point is contentment? Do you think the point is to not have desire?
To not have?
To not have desire.
Not have desire. Okay, it is, the point in Buddhism is to learn how to not have desire when you don't need it.
When you don't need it?
Well, because sometimes when there's something to do, for example, if I need to go to the toilet, and if I have no desire, I'll do it right here. And that's just gross.
Good answer.
Okay, thank you.